RN, your world unfolding.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Glad you could join me for Big Ideas here on your radio on RN, online at abc.net.au/radio national or on your pod. What influence do you think the media has on scientific research? Tonight, we're off to the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney and a forum presented by the Royal Society of New South Wales. We're well and truly into the digital era, and for the media, this means a massive transformation is underway. You're now faced with more choice than ever before, and it's growing every day. But are you tempted to simply gravitate toward that which merely reinforces your existing worldview? Are your horizons expanding or contracting? In particular, how well does the new media communicate and disseminate science? There's a huge amount of unfiltered data out there, one of our speakers tonight notes, and while many will strongly support freedom of speech, what about the need for responsible communication? Science is supposed to be objective and based on facts, so why have issues like climate change, vaccination, genetically modified food, and fluoride in the water supply been so controversial in recent years? Discussing these and other questions are Professor Jill Treweller, Deputy Vice Chancellor Research at the University of Sydney, and Mark Scott, the Managing Director of the ABC. Let's head now to the Powerhouse and this discussion on the influence of the media on scientific research, moderated by RN's own science broadcaster, Robin Williams.
I'd like to start on a romantic note and describe when I first met Mark Scott. It was about 6 years ago, and we were sitting next to each other on the board of the Science Media Centre, which was being set up. And we indeed had the pleasure with Peter Yates, the chairman of the Science Media Centre, to appoint the managing director, who's been there for 6 years now. And it's one of the great successes of Australia, and I know that Mark Scott's going to talk about it in a minute. What it does, in case you don't know, is alert the mainstream press about events that have a scientific edge, if you like. And the way that they've produced graphs of their impact has been really quite stunning. And that's not simply to do with responding to crises, everything from the Christchurch earthquake to Fukushima and the floods and so forth, but general science, you know, funding questions and such like. It's been really a marvellous experience to see how well they've done. And yet they seem to be quite invisible because they don't have their logo attached to news stories. They're, in that sense, invisible. So what you see from our point of view is a continuing healthy impact, if you like, on the public awareness. And yet, of course, it's somehow fashionable, always has been, somehow to discount that kind of success. Because, as you know, a collection of scientists is known as a whinge, and a collection of science journalists a hangover. And if you put those together, you get a fairly bleak outlook on what the world is like in many ways. And some of it is justified, but a lot of it isn't. I remember broadcasting Michael Crichton, who wrote Jurassic Park, that great big streak sometimes of insightfulness and sometimes of denying, if you like, the less political aspects of some things. And he once made a wonderful address to scientists showing, in fact, that they really had a tremendous press compared to accountants, compared to lawyers, compared to politicians, compared to many professions. They do pretty damn well. And he said that if you look at some of the complaints about Jurassic Park, where the main character, played by Attenborough, Richard Attenborough this time, was a demon of a scientist. In fact, he was a businessman, and the heroes were scientists. And so if you look at the evidence about the profile of science, it's not that bad, but it is mixed. I had the experience only a few days ago of offering a three-minute piece for one of our rather long radio programmes, which is devoted to news and current affairs. And this happened to be about the H5N1 virus, which had been designed in a laboratory and was likely to be the most dangerous germ in history, which had the potential to wipe out civilization. And the interview I had was with the editor of the journal Science, the previous president of the American Academy, Bruce Alberts, about as high up as you can get in science without actually leaving the ground. And, of course, that was the day that Julia and Kevin had a brawl. And so the whole of that 3 hours was occupied by discussing that, or rather reiterating the one observation that anyone had over 3 hours. And our item was kind of dropped. And so I've got the kind of and finally view sometimes of the place of science in the media if you're not careful, which is why it's so wonderful having a science unit, or in fact 3 science units in the ABC. So that's kind of generally the background, and to speak first on what it's like being in charge of characters like us and the place of science in the media, would you please welcome Mark Scott.
Well, thanks, Robin. Ladies and gentlemen, good to be with you. I thought what I might do as an initial contribution is to talk a little bit about science at the ABC, but also talk a little bit about the patterns and the changes that are affecting media organisations as we move into a digital era, and then some observations, I think, about what that's meaning and doing for the coverage of science, what we're doing about it at the ABC, but generally the trends that we are seeing in place. I think I comfortably speak clearly as a representative and finally as editor-in-chief of the ABC's content, and I'm happy to speak in defence of the decisions we're making and talking through the processes we're making. I can't speak on behalf of all the media, though, but the one thing I would say very clearly is I think the media as an industry, that kind of form of mass communication, is undergoing the greatest transformation since the era of Gutenberg. And sometimes said that some of these technological changes, their impacts are often overestimated in the short term, but underestimated in the long term. And I think that's exactly what we are seeing now as this extraordinary transformation sweeps the communications industry. As Robin suggested, you know, science, I think, has a very special space and history for us at the ABC. Some of our most iconic broadcasters, of whom Exhibit A is in the front row, Robin and Carl Krasniewski, Norman Swan, a range of other broadcasters have been with us for a long period of time and have a very special relationship and trust with our audiences through programs like the Science Show and the Health Report and Catalyst and other programs that, of course, you'd be aware of. But I think one of the most interesting things about the ABC and what we try and do is how we embed science across a range of our platforms. So it's not just on Radio National, but Dr. Carl having a very important role in science and science media and science education on Triple J, our local radio programs engaging around science, having specialist journalists who report science news for our television services, and even programs on children's programs like BTN and the Surfing Scientists, focusing on making science engaging and understandable for children. And I would think that fairly regularly, even programs like Australian Story and Four Corners will venture into the area. I think one of the things that Robin has done for us in particular, not only just a brilliant communicator of complexity to a broad audience, but through his reputation and experience and contacts, has really opened the doors of the ABC to a host of national and international experts on science and created forums whereby they can come and communicate directly with our audience. So one of the things I think is interesting about the ABC is that we were formed and created in a time of media scarcity. The ABC turns 80 this year, and when we were started in 1932, there was a sense that there were relatively few radio stations, and there should be a network of radio stations that were focused on delivering what commercial broadcasters wouldn't deliver. And it was exactly the same in 1956 when the ABC started on television. There was a sense that there would be some programming that you'd want the public broadcaster to do because commercial broadcasters would not be able to find a business model that would enable them to do that. I think now what's happening in media is the absolute opposite. It's not that there is a scarcity of content, a scarcity of broadcasters, a scarcity of program. We've got a flood of that now. More choice becoming available for our audiences than ever before. If you think back to the experience of radio, we started off with a handful of radio stations, but you can go to iTunes now And on that opening page of iTunes, you can access 6,000 radio stations from around the world. You think about television, we had three television channels, four, five, now we have 20 television channels on free-to-air television, hundreds more on pay TV, and we will see in coming years, with smart television sets connected to the internet, the access of thousands and thousands of different sources of television content. And when Google and Apple and others get into that content area, we will just be flooded for information, flooded for choice. And one of the things I think we reflect on that at the ABC is the arguments around the ABC will be just as important in that era of media plenty as it was in that era of media scarcity. And that is because, in a sense, the business models to do things like quality Australian drama or programming around the arts or programming around science, programming that is expensive to create, that will be very difficult for commercial broadcasters to do if they are trying to make profits in an era when there is so much choice for advertisers and for audiences. And so we would argue, even though we've got a proud history in areas like Australian content and arts and science and the like, that the role of the ABC to fulfil that important space will continue into the future. One of the things I think we're really seeing in this new digital era is the absolute lowering of the barriers to entry if you want to broadcast, if you want to publish. It used to be that if you wanted to broadcast on radio and television, you needed to have a licence, and that licence allocated spectrum for you to be able to broadcast. So there were very few people who had the money and the resources to be able to do that, and that's why the giants of media in Australia were so powerful and so wealthy. It used to be that if you wanted to publish a newspaper that reached a city, you'd need a printing press. And when I was at Fairfax, where I was before I joined the ABC, a new printing press of that size cost $300 million. But now anyone with a computer, anyone plugged into an online world, can publish and can broadcast. And so we live in a world with a couple of 100 million websites, 60,000 new blogs being created every day. And that fundamentally changes the nature of discourse and the ecology that something like the ABC is broadcasting in. And I think one of the things that we are seeing a breakdown of and a challenge for the role of the ABC is this sense of a shared community, a shared town square, a shared area of interest. And if you are obsessed or interested or focused in a narrow area, then there is content that is available for you that reinforces your view, reinforces your understanding, and is a worldview that you can slot into. And I think the great example you can see of this is in American politics now, that if you are of a conservative mindset, you can find radio stations and television stations and websites that simply reinforce your view, not expose you to a broader plurality of views the way it would have once been the case. And I think one of the challenges we face in coverage of science is in fact that kind of narrowness of communities of interest that are emerging at this time, a narrowness of views. I think the web makes it possible for these communities who may have a narrow view around something like vaccination or climate change or genetically modified food or water fluoridation and the like to find other kindred spirits, to circulate information amongst themselves, for there to be a narrow side eddy of information that they are swimming and reinforcing themselves in, and that having a credibility or developing a credibility for that audience in its own right. One of the things I can comment on from my position now is that I think nearly all my predecessors for the best part of half a century would have said the threshold issue that they get more mail on and more engagement on would have been around Middle East politics. Well, I think I can safely say in the last few years I get far more around contentious issues of science than I do around Middle Eastern politics, with active and vibrant communities powered by the opportunities that are presenting them through digital media. How does the ABC approach these issues? We have editorial policies that Robin memorises and reads as his morning devotions every morning before he turns on the microphone. But these are guidelines that we give to our journalists to help them wade their way through these complexities and these loud and committed voices that are approaching us. And these are hallmarks of impartiality. We ask our journalists in covering contentious issues to have a balance that follows the weight of evidence, to give fair treatment, to be open-minded, and to provide opportunities over time for principal relevant perspectives. But I would say, particularly around scientific issues, there's an intensity of engagement around some of these issues that is growing over time in this era of digital media rather than diminishing. And I think Robin would have interesting perspectives on that, given his experience. The other thing I would say is that we need to recognise that the media is operating in a commercial space, that the editor of the Daily Telegraph fundamentally is part of a business organisation that is attempting to maximise profit for their shareholders. And one of the things that is a challenge, I think, to understand from the outside of the industry, if you're not working in commercial industry, is that commercial media is really all about the advertising. The advertising is the thing that drives the dollars, is the thing that drives the business. And the content is about how you can attract the audience to sell the advertising. And whilst we do have journalistic standards and codes of ethics and everything else, the business model is driven by attracting the audience that you can sell to the advertisers. And the news is often the stuff that fills in the gap between the ads. And so we may have aspirations and expectations about what we want media organisations to do, but often they are very much focused by the business models and the economic models that are driving their business and the pressures that they are under. And one of the things I would say is I think the gap between the quality and the commitment of the ABC to serious news and serious current affairs, but the gap between us and what is being offered by commercial broadcasters, I think, is growing over time, as commercial broadcasters are more and more focused on how they deliver to shareholders and the bottom line, and there are fewer proprietors out there who are willing to, in a sense, sustain the profitability of commercial media organisations over time. Some of that may all sound a little bit bleak, but I think there are tremendous things that are emerging in this digital era around science and science coverage as well. And one of the things, and Robin may be able to talk about this more, is the ability to tap into the expertise and the wisdom that exists in your audience. I sometimes used to think that a newsroom of journalists was full of people who didn't know what was going on, reporting to an audience where people actually did know what was going on. And part of the hunt and the challenge was to find people in the audience who could fill you in on what was happening, and then you take that information and package it. But I think there is no doubt in this era, with the two-way dynamic that digital media creates, the opportunity for your audience to engage back with you, to report back to you, to log in online, to tap into their expertise, provides tremendous opportunities to find different people, to gain different insights, to tap into the expertise of your audience in significant ways. And there is no doubt that we are certainly experiencing some of that, some of those opportunities as they exist over time. Let me conclude, and there'll be opportunities for discussion, of course, down the track, to talk a little bit about the Science Media Centre, because I think this was a great initiative and undertaking. It was driven by Mike Rann in South Australia, Peter Yates. Robin was one of the pioneers and continues to serve on the board. To say that, was there something that we could do as editors, as media proprietors, as media owners, to lift the general overall understanding of science and the reporting of science in the community? And part of it, I think, was a recognition of the practical reality of newsrooms and organisations now. Most newsrooms around the country, the ABC is an exception, but most newsrooms around the country are much smaller than they once were. One of the things that's happened is a decline of specialists who would report only around health or only around education or only around science or only around transport. People who had a specialisation and a depth of insight and a level of contacts that developed and grew deeper and richer over the years, that brought their own specialisation to their subject reporting. And a recognition that often the person who wrote the transport story one day would write the science story the next day and the health story the next day and the education story the day after. And how do you help generalists who pick up a science story to quickly be able to come to terms with some of the complexity, to be able to identify the credible sources, to be a little more immune to the PR spin that often exists around some of these areas? Well, the Science Media Centre, which was established in South Australia, I think was a real answer to that. Firstly, to be able to provide and develop fact-based material around key scientific areas to provide a base level of understanding for journalists and reporters. Secondly, to be able to provide connections and contacts and help journalists find credible people in the fields that they were reporting on. And then, as importantly, to help scientists in their dealings back with media to be effective communicators, to be able to synthesise their research and be able to present it in a way that would be easy for journalists to appreciate, to understand and to engage with. As Robin said, I think the Science Media Centre does not particularly have a high profile itself, but you can see the fingerprints and the impact of the Science Media Centre across a range of major stories that our journalists are covering at the ABC and elsewhere over time. The origins of the Science Media Centre in Australia was the Science Media Centre that was established in the UK, and that really emerged out of, I think, some quite horrendous reporting of very complex issues, atrocious reporting, particularly in the tabloids over a period of time. And others may take a different view. I don't think we've seen the same level of atrocity and excess in Australian science reporting as they saw in the UK. And I think one of the reasons for that, a strong preventative reason for that, has been the establishment of the work of the Science Media Centre. And I think it's an opportunity where the media has come together to try and raise the bar, to try and raise the standards and to raise the level of performance as far as science media reporting is concerned across the entire media sector. I think it's a very positive thing. Robin, I'll pause there and there'll be opportunities for cross-examination later on, I feel sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. One of the most startling things you were saying when I first met you as the chief editor, really, of Fairfax, was that every day the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age produces enough in the way of words to be equivalent to a major novel. Every day. And if you look at the electronic media now, 24 hours a day, on all these networks, we're churning out the stuff. And the question is, how do you maintain the quality control? How do you police facts? How much do the researchers stand by to look for any kind of slip-ups there may have been? And, of course, we're closer and closer to the edge all the time. Talking about the old days, I was rather wistful about remembering in 1972 when I first joined the ABC. If you reported on something to do with health, especially something like cancer that was contentious and sensitive, what you had to do is write a letter to the Department of Health in Canberra saying what the story was that you had in mind, and you'd post it, and they would post a reply back saying whether you could or could not at some stage do that story, and then you set off and acted accordingly. And the day I stopped that was when I had a phone call from someone in Canberra asking my advice on a request that had come from my department on a story we had in mind to do. And I thought the whole thing has become not a virtuous circle, but a silly circle. If you are considering the impact of science, then one measure might be how many young people are signing up for degree courses in our universities. And of course, the chief scientist, Ian Chubb, has been quite vocal this year saying how many engineers we actually need, and tens or hundreds of thousands of people in science, and the deficit is quite extraordinary and startling and could affect the well-being of the economy of this country. So there is a concern about the public view of science in that regard, and perhaps Jill Trewella will talk about that because she has spent a long time at the top of Australian science. She's Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at the University of Sydney, spent a long time in America, and in fact arrived from America only hours ago. So please welcome and thank Jill Trewella.
May I formally thank Mark and Robin for the excellence of the ABC programming. It is gratifying to have an organisation like the ABC that does think about principled and relevant perspectives and present high-quality programming. It is certainly an extremely valuable contribution to public education, inspiration, and even to the public debate that might influence the political process. And I think those are the three areas that I've been thinking about in the way that the media relates to science. That is, as a means for education, as a means for inspiring, in particular for inspiring the next generation of researchers, perhaps scientists and engineers. And as a means for supporting the public debate that would eventually influence the political process. These are incredibly important roles. More important as our world moves towards more critical issues that require an understanding of science, an understanding of the scientific process, and how scientists come to a consensus view about the state of science and their state of understanding of the natural world. There's been a big confusion of late about what represents scientific opinion, scientific fact, and articles of faith. As a scientist trained to observe, gather evidence, interpret evidence, publish my interpretation of that evidence, have it tested and challenged by my peers, and then either discarded or become part of the consensus view, it is disappointing to hear someone say, "Do you believe in climate change?" Belief is about faith. Faith has a role in our society, and we have articles of faith by which we make certain judgments and make decisions about our lives. But whether or not the temperature of the earth is changing is not an article of faith. There is evidence that needs to be assessed. And the current consensus in the scientific community is that we are experiencing climate change and that man's activities are contributing to it. But the public debate about climate change is about whether you believe in climate change. And that's largely a reflection of the inability of a broad enough constituency in our societies. I don't know how broad it would need to be. I think that needs to be thought about. Of actually understanding the scientific body of evidence and the process by which a consensus is derived. I'm not to say here that there is scientific absolute truth about climate change. There are still things that we are learning about climate change, and there is more data to come in. But when issues around climate change are reported as if the broad consensus in the scientific community is the same as the outlying opinion or set of opinions, there's more than an outlying opinion, or a flaw is found in the way some people have been conducting their science in this area, and it is made to completely undermine the entire body of work, this is when the public is not served well in the public debate. There are many issues that need an understanding of science and the scientific process that we face these days. Climate change, I used because we're all familiar with that. There are many others. The great focus that we have on health reporting and health research is something that often gives me pause. Who could argue against health research? We've all been impacted by relatives who have suffered from cancer or terrible neurological disease, early aging, things that have torn us emotionally in pieces. And wouldn't it be wonderful if medicine could provide a cure so that the next person who was inflicted with that terrible disease would not have to suffer? This has given medical research globally, really, an enormous constituency and advocacy and an acceptance in the general community that anything that you spend on medical research is a good thing. And that probably is true. The question is, can you continue escalating your levels of investment in medical research while continuing to decrease your investment in other sciences and engineering? Some of which have far greater and far broader impact on the quality of our lives than we understand, including, interestingly, our ability to advance biomedical research, which requires new materials, requires engineered systems, requires ICT, information and communications technology, in order to reach all those places that we need to reach. So I think that the media has an opportunity to, as a community, to think about how they want to see their future as a community. As a scientist, I would not have much impact if I sat in my laboratory and did wonderful, high-quality research and published it and never kind of went outside the bounds of what I could do. I work in a fairly esoteric field. I look at the small-angle scattering of neutrons from biological molecules. That's my research area. I'm internationally recognized for being able to do this. Not many people do it. It's a useful thing to do, though. We do learn about basic biology, basic molecular biology. I have spent the last 2-3 years, after many, many years of being a practitioner, establishing the standards by which people would judge the quality of the data they produce and the results that they obtain and publish. So I think it is true that we're living in an era where there's just a huge amount of unfiltered data out there. There are strong advocates for freedom of the press. I would like to see strong advocates, equally strong advocates out there for responsible communication. I do think that it's really critical for us as a society to consider whether or not we want to continue to have public opinion driven by a business model that depends on advertising. We could say it's too big to have an impact and too big to change, but the impact on decision makers, including the decision makers who are voting for our people who are take up our elected offices, and the impact on political processes is huge. And so I think it's an issue that can't continue to be set aside because it's too big to solve. As an executive these days in a higher education institution, one of the things I struggle with daily is the reality that the research enterprise of my university depends on a $240 million cross-subsidy from teaching and learning income. That is the gap between what we are given to do our research and what it costs to do the research, somewhere between 15 and 20% of the total university budget. Philanthropy refuses to pay indirect costs, particularly philanthropic organizations who are focused on research into diseases, refuse to pay the indirect costs for research. This is actually a big public debate, because this cross-subsidy is impacting the quality of our teaching and learning, our educating, our ability to produce the next generation of researchers. And it's also impacting our ability to do research. And the universities are the main engines for research and innovation in our societies. I think this should be part of the public debate, and there should be a place where we can have this dialogue and have more informed opinion at the voting booth in particular. So I would ask the ABC in particular, actually, there's just one thing I would ask of the ABC, which is in the nightly evening news broadcast, which I watch very regularly, I very regularly see the latest advance in health research. That advance almost always has a promise that's about 10 years out. Could we please also have a short segment on advances in research in other disciplines? That would be, for me, a great ABC Nightly News event, because I think there are many disciplines across the physical sciences, the life sciences, the social sciences, that we need to address the issues that we have today in regards to the sustainability of our food supply, the sustainability of our energy supplies, social discord and unrest, the problems we have in modern governance, in economies that are driven by a fundamental business model that depends on things related to advertising. So I think I'll just leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there was a request, Mark, for you to do something.
Yes.
What's your response?
I take it on notice, Robin, I think. I think, you know, I had a group of representatives of the visual and creative arts in the other day, novelists, representatives of the kind of the peak interest groups, and they had one request of me. They said every night on the 7 o'clock news there would be a dedicated space to arts and arts coverage. I'm sure if I had leading clerics in, they would point out to me that more people attend church on a Sunday than attend a football match, and so they don't want 15 minutes of sport, but we should, you know, and I think, so I understand the argument, it's not a unique argument. I simply throw the challenge right back to the scientific community. We are after a compelling, dynamic, interesting news bulletin that is directly relevant and engaging to our audience. I note your view, minority one though it is. You say that, but it's interesting. From my days in newspapers, there's hardly any advertising in the sporting pages of the newspapers, but it's the kind of thing that if you took out, the sales would dramatically decrease. If they could take out those pages, they would, but they don't because it drives audience. We think sport is part of the mix that our audience wants as part of a news bulletin. But what I was going to say about science is this. If, in fact, there are those compelling, important, interesting, creative, dynamic stories that are directly relevant to our audience in the hallowed halls of our learned institutions, can our learned institutions please find a way of informing and engaging us on those stories so we can tell them? We have no bias against those stories, but this is the first communications exercise is back with us, and the ability to actually take that work, that research, recognising the constraints that we have, you know, 2 minutes to tell that story, to find them and to communicate them more broadly, because we are in the market for them, quite frankly. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think the health industries, if you like, and health research have done is they had mastered the skills to be able to kind of package and tell those stories in a way that we think is of great interest to our audience, and commercial broadcasters do as well. So I accept the challenge. I throw it right back, and hopefully there can be a good response.
I'll catch it.
Yeah, got it.
Thank you.
Professor Jill Trewella, Deputy Vice-Chancellor Research at the University of Sydney, and Mark Scott, Managing Director of the ABC. On Big Ideas here on RN, you've been listening to a forum on the influence of the media on scientific research, presented by the Royal Society of New South Wales and moderated by ABC science broadcaster Robin Williams. Time now to return to the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney for some questions from the audience.
I take your point about there being precious few scientists out there willing to actually actively engage the wider public and really argue on these matters. But, you know, we touched on Q&A, and I think climate change is probably one of the most frequently discussed topics on Q&A. And it's a bit of a running joke in scientists that the most common thing you'll hear on Q&A when they start discussing climate change comes from an economist or a politician or an ethicist saying, "Now, I'm not a scientist, but here's what I think about climate change." Why don't we see more scientists on shows like Q&A directly discussing the science rather than the social implications? Now, obviously, there are important economic and social implications, but why don't we see more scientists?
Yeah, it's a good question. Oh, look, I think the Q&A guest list is a perennial one that we kind of try and work our way through. I mean, I think, but by and large, Q&A, the discourse is meant to be quite general, so it can roam everywhere. And so I suppose there is a bias towards people who will be able to speak kind of across a broad range of issues. So I think Ian Chubb's been on Q&A, and Tim Flannery certainly been on Q&A. There have been scientists who can speak quite broadly and generally who we'd invite on. I think we're in the market for good talent. I mean, you want people who can speak broadly and credibly across a range of issues, but who are good, engaging talent, broad, you know. And so we're in the market for that. And there's always a bias a little bit on Q&A when you're casting it, really, to go back to people who are proven performers and then to bring in new over time. So they have quite a long list of people who are in the pipeline ready to run, and we'll get to them over a period of time. But that's why I think, when we have done Q&As on
things like population. We did one on population a while ago. You'll get scientists, I think, there who are specialists on population. But a scientist who was an expert on one subject and one subject alone, unless it was a specially targeted Q&A, would not usually get the Guernsey. It's the person who can be very broad. And I think that's something about Tim Flannery, that given his background and his expertise, you know, he's broad, and he's broad beyond even science to talk about the politics, economics, the range of things. That's the, in a nutshell.
What about in America, Jill? You've spent long enough there. What do you think of the science broadcasts there handling such contentious issues?
Well, America has very much gone to the specialist broadcaster mode, if you like. I think this has developed the supreme art of providing outlets for people to hear what they wish to hear.
They send them off to their own channels.
Yeah, they send exactly. And so there are wonderful science channels. You know, there's the Discovery Channel.
Sure.
So if you're a science buff, you can find what you want. And National Public Radio, Public Broadcasting Corporation, it just has very high quality material. I think that the difficulty really is that in order for this kind of communication to be successful and broadly accessible, you really do need to think about how to make it more relevant, more entertaining, more captivating, and really how to inspire people to want to study and understand science. Mm. The media played a huge role in the Sputnik era of inspiring an incredible burst of people to study science and engineering.
Yeah.
It was just incredible. Everybody just went off to university to study, become scientists and engineers.
I did too.
And so I think, and what happened in the 1980s, 1990s, biology and the life sciences felt for a long time they'd played second fiddle to physics. 20th century was really the century of physics, and the Manhattan Project in some ways gifted that century of physics a big stimulus. So in biology, they decided they wanted a Manhattan Project, and that was the Human Genome Project. Mm.
Yeah. Several questions. Yes, please. Current president.
One of the things that troubles me, and I'd be interested in first Jill's opinion and then Mark's, is that if you have the media facilitating this debate on very complex issues, which, as Robin says, have got many, many facts that everyone often agrees about, the real issue which I find lacking in Australian intellectual life is the whole critical thinking. And you just don't see it here the way you see it in other countries overseas, particularly in Europe. I mean, you mentioned the issues around falsifying scientific theories that Karl Popper was famous for identifying. Well, he was absolutely hammered by people like Jürgen Habermas, cultural theorists in Germany, for ignoring all of the cultural and critical issues around developing science policy, which I think was pretty influential in Europe. And you don't find that here. How do we get that sort of good critical debate? I mean, I don't really care what Nick Minchin thinks about climate change. I might be interested in why he thinks it, but what I really want to understand is how people think and address the facts and draw their conclusions from those facts so that I can be more informed.
Jill?
So stimulating critical thinking in the Australian society, I'm not sure that I'm really qualified to answer.
It's a big question.
It's a big question. It's a very big question. And I would have to say that one of the observations I've had in returning to Australia after being gone for 25 years was that there is a tendency in Australia to look overseas for the answers. I experienced this to some extent in science. I see it often in business that would rather import the technology than invest in Australian innovation. And I see it sometimes in the public discourse where the Australian tendency to look overseas for the answers and for the critical thinking. And I think that's a shame, because I think we have as much talent, as much innovation, as much imagination as anyone on the planet.
I'll be hard-pressed to get such a popular answer. But can I just take a slightly contrary view, I think? I think you can make an argument that says, if you are interested in ideas in Australia, there have never been more opportunities for you to swim and engage in a sea of ideas from Australia and around the world, and never been more opportunities for you to participate in that conversation. I think, you know, if you're interested in ideas now, and you think of the global ideas, the fact that you can go online and there, you're not waiting. I remember as a school kid, I subscribed to the New Yorker. They'd arrive by ship. 3 months later, you get six in the mailbox at once, and it was pretty hopeless. But now, of course, you can read the New Yorker before the people in New York get it in their mailbox, or the New York Review of Books, or the London Review of Books, or any journals that you want. You can be part of that global conversation. I think you take a snapshot of what happens in this city now. They announce the lineup for the Sydney Writers Festival. That'll happen here in May. Just be sold out. You go down there during that weekend, there will be 10,000 people roaming around, sitting in debates by, you know, writers and critics engaged around ideas. The Opera House sells out 3 days in a row in the October long weekend on the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. The Wheeler Centre in Melbourne has speakers 3 or 4 nights a week around this discourse. Radio National is full of it. The Conversation has been an important addition to it, which I think taps into the academic community more. And I think there is more debate and discussion or opportunities for that if you want to do it than has ever happened in the past. Now, it may not be quite London or New York or Vienna now, but I think that has been a positive thing. And I think that's what the online world has really done for many people outside academia. It's given them exposure and engagement to the best brains, the best ideas, and an opportunity to contribute and respond and be part of that conversation that's been the case before. And I think that's a positive thing. Now, whether in fact that's migrating to policy and priorities, whatever, I think that's a separate conversation. But I just think the climate for people who want to be engaged in the battle of ideas has never been better in some respects. And I think we see that with Q&A.
Oh, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, they're up.
Thank you. My day job is corrupting the young at the University of New South Wales, and I do research in chemistry as well. And I wonder if we ought to look at the distinction between the educative role of the media that the great discovery programs, the series that we do really well and explain to the people in the world how it all works, in a received wisdom that we're more or less happy with, and then these huge debates that we're having at the moment over climate change and other things. I would say the vaccination debate is on the educative side, I should say, but for climate change and some of the other things, because they are very difficult. They're not easy. We have the debate through the peer-reviewed literature because it's so awkward. It takes years to work out whether you're right or wrong. I mean, it's Jill was saying earlier. I mean, there's going to be another debate that's coming up, which is we're just about to change, or there's been a proposal to change, 4 out of the 7 base units of the SI system. So in a few years' time, we're going to change the basic measurement units that everybody uses here. And there's an enormous debate about it. People are calling each other names, and it just really hasn't filtered through to the media. But I dread it ever would, because as soon as it gets out there, people are going to be writing placards, you know, save our kilogram, or what are you going to do about the mole, or what have you. I mean, I have a nice cartoon that has two old blokes in armchairs, and the caption is, they're clearly scientists, and they say, and the caption is, well, Carruthers, thank God we never stooped to popularising science.
That does really sound like a priesthood, though.
Should we take that as a statement?
Yeah, I'll take that as a comment, I think, is the Tony Jones phrase. Yeah.
Another one over there at the back, the gentleman with the beard.
I was very curious about what you were saying earlier about with as media becomes more polarised, as people become sort of more likely to only read the newspapers that they're going to read, see the websites that they're going to already agree with. Sort of to use the old Stephen Colbert line that reality has a well-known liberal bias, how is the ABC going to, I guess, inoculate itself from accusations of being very, very left-wing as the gap between left and right, particularly in the media, becomes stronger and stronger?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I get as many complaints from the left as I do from the right these days around the ABC positioning. I think one of the advantages that we have, and I don't think this is about science, but it's more generally about coverage of issues. We have a number of forums, insiders, Q&A, The Drum and others, where we invite a range of different views and a range of different perspectives. And I think we can say on many of the issues of debate in a community that a range of views are heard and voices are heard, and then when we come to examine those programs and question them and we have people on for interviews, we provide a robust and forensic examination of the arguments that they raise. But our view, our aspiration, frankly, is to be the town square and to be one of the few remaining town squares that exists in the media. A place where people can come to speak and be heard, to listen and to understand, where there'll be a range of views and there'll be a robust debate and engagement around those ideas. And we still think there is space for us there. And, you know, I'll conclude on this. What I think is interesting about this era is an increased intolerance to hearing views that don't align with your own. I think it's almost an angrier mailbag that we get now. Why did you let those people on? Why do you let those people on? And almost a breaking down of the convention that says in a debate you will hear different views and those different views will be tested. And I think part of the narrow casting that is a feature of the new era is a sense that you do not want to hear voices that aren't your own, that aren't reflecting your own views. And I think part of the role of the ABC is to be that broad church, to be that town square, to be that place for engagement and contest around ideas. And that's the role we're going to try and play.
We'll take that as a splendid final statement. Jill, do you want to make a final statement?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I cheer the ABC in that aspiration and that role. And I think as a society, we need to think how we can promote and demand more civil discourse, not just in the media, but in the political debate, in everything we do, because the breakdown of civil discourse that really is part of the problem that we're trying to deal with, and it is the extreme polarization and the extreme language that is really preventing us from moving towards good solutions for some of the issues that we face.
Thank you both very much.
Professor Jill Treweller, Deputy Vice Chancellor Research at the University of Sydney and Managing Director of the ABC, Mark Scott. They were discussing the influence of the media on scientific research, a forum presented by the Royal Society of New South Wales. Thanks to Robin Williams from RN's Science Show for moderating tonight's forum.